From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's Final Four weekend, so where are all the marquee players on the men's side? That story's just ahead on Only a Game. Also, a look at the women's Final Four squads before UConn finishes crushing everyone. A cautionary tale of what happens when you bring your favorite kitty cat mug to an NCAA tournament game, and an anything but pedestrian history of American competitive walking. Also coming up, meet the six-time Winter Olympian who traded her luge for a quiver amid questions that her age and injuries might prevent her from making the 2014 Summer Games as an archer.
I don't even think that way. That's not my brain doesn't even, I don't know how to answer that question. There is no not making it.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Monday, as Wisconsin, Florida, Kentucky, and UConn prepared for this weekend's Final Four, Andrew Wiggins of Kansas declared his eligibility for the 2014 NBA Draft. And he's not the only blue chipper who will not be part of the extended madness. Here to talk about the departure of some of the season's best men's college basketball players is Pat Forte of Yahoo Sports. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be with you.
Kansas lost in the second round of the tournament, so fans didn't get much of a chance to see Wiggins play in this postseason, nor will they see him in the future. What are they missing out on?
Well, he's a phenomenal athlete, incredible jumping ability, lateral quickness for 6'7". That makes him an excellent defender. But, you know, my concern with him, he's a little bit of a wallflower-type personality. You know, I don't think he has much of a takeover mentality. If somebody wants to spend $50, $60 million on making him the face of your franchise, I'm not sure he wants to be that face. So it's a bit of a risky endeavor, I think.
Wiggins has been projected to go no later than the third pick in the draft. Is that all of the motivation he needs to declare this year and forego the chance to lead Kansas deep into the NCAA tournament for the next 1, 2, or 3 years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're a top three pick, heck, there's a lot of guys that will leave if they're a top 30 pick. So if you are going to be picked in that position, you go. No looking back, whether you're ready or not.
What other players are you sorry that fans didn't get to see more of in this year's big dance?
Well, certainly Joel Embiid, who is Wiggins' teammate at Kansas, didn't get to see him at all because he had a back injury. Some people believe he's the best NBA prospect of all, you know, wonderfully skilled seven-footer. I mean, can really pass and handle the ball and shoot, too. He can do pretty well everything. He's still very raw, but I wouldn't be surprised if he is the overall number one pick. And then also Jabari Parker from Duke, wonderfully talented guy, plays really hard, very competitive, and he really kind of was playing out of position at Duke as a more of a power forward. He'll be a small forward in the NBA. You know, those two guys are fantastic talents, and I think they will be star players in the NBA for many, many years.
It's interesting that you mention those two, because though many of the NBA's worst teams have denied it, there has been a lot of tanking going on this season. I guess those teams had no inkling of the possibility that Wiggins' teammate, center Joel Embiid, and Duke's Jabari Parker are reportedly pondering a return to their college teams.
Yes, that is the report. I would be shocked if either do return. The play sorry for Jabari or concede for Embiid movements have been in full effect for a long time. I don't think anybody expects them to have a change of heart this close to getting their payday as professional athletes.
I would think another problem with some of these guys, and I know it's worked out really well for some players to get into the NBA very young, but for some of these guys, they are still very young to get into the grind of that kind of job.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, it's a risky proposition, I think. I'm not sure there's many who are terribly well-suited for that. There may be the rare LeBron James who at 18, 19 could handle it, not just being able to excel on the floor, but handle the grind of being a professional athlete. The demands on you are significant. The season is more than twice as long as anything you've played before, and your coach will be more demanding of you as well. I mean, it's not an easy lifestyle. That's why they get paid that much money. So I'm not sure there are many teenagers out there that are really cut out for it.
Currently, the NBA's minimum age requirement is 19. The league's newly minted commissioner, Adam Silver, has made raising that limit a priority. Would you be in favor of that?
Yeah, I would. What I'd really, truly be in favor of is an either-or, where you could come out at 18, so you don't have to pretend you're a student, or you stay for a minimum of 2 years. I think that would be a good solution. But 20 would be better than 19. 21 would be better than 20. A college degree would be best of all, but I know that's naive. We don't live in those days anymore.
Pat Forte is a national columnist for Yahoo Sports. Pat, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
The NCAA Women's Tournament will crown a champion on Tuesday night. Two semifinal games on Sunday will determine whether the final will feature the two teams everybody has been assuming it would feature for most of the season, UConn and Notre Dame. Joining me is ESPN's Michelle Smith. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Maryland, a 4 seed, is the longest shot in the Final Four. They beat a number 1 seed, Tennessee, to reach the main stage. Were they underappreciated when the tournament began?
I don't think so. I think this is one of those teams that was probably playing really well at the end of the season, and then they just kept playing well through the tournament. They did knock off Tennessee, and then they went and knocked off Louisville at Louisville in the regional finals. So this is a team that's got some serious basketball chops at this point, and they'll be headed to the Final Four with some momentum.
The Terrapins will play Notre Dame in the first semifinal on Sunday. There was, I assume, no doubt that Notre Dame would be a number 1 seed.
No, Notre Dame was absolutely a number 1 seed, being one of the two unbeaten teams going into the tournament. I think that the conversation was at that point whether or not it would be, say, Connecticut or Notre Dame as the overall number 1 seed, although I don't think anybody disputes that Connecticut has been the national title favorite since the season began and probably since the last season ended. But Notre Dame is a very good team, but the storyline has changed a little bit with the ACL injury to Natalie Achonwa, who was one of their best players, one of their senior leaders, was averaging 20 points a game in the NCAA tournament, and now the Irish will play without her.
An AP article written about the regional semifinals of the tournament featured this headline, "Bigger crowds and blowouts." Bigger crowds is good for the women's game, of course, not so much blowouts, right?
No, not so much, but I don't think that was universally true. I mean, going to home sites for the regional semifinals and finals was sort of a one-time only thing that the tournament committee decided to do this year. And I would say this, having covered games at one of the home sites at Stanford, it is a trade-off for the women's game because you are trading off loud crowds and very full arenas for what many coaches feel is a competitive disadvantage to have to play such an important game on somebody else's home court.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that the games were close in the regional final rounds by and large, and I also think there was great crowd support, so I think it's not an easy choice for women's basketball.
Stanford has had only one fairly close game in the tournament, which is one more than Notre Dame or Connecticut has had. Stanford only beat North Carolina in the quarterfinals by 9 points. Did they look good enough on that night to go any further?
You know, there isn't anybody probably outside of the Stanford locker room and the Stanford family who thinks they have a shot against Connecticut just because of the season Connecticut's had and how complete they are as a team. But they're such familiar opponents. This will be their fourth meeting in the Final Four in the last 7 years. These coaches know each other well. These two teams played in November. I mean, there certainly aren't any secrets here. So I think for Stanford, it's a matter of playing at their absolute best to have a shot. And I think then it still is probably just a shot.
Okay, enough compulsory window dressing. I, like almost everybody else, am assuming that the final will see Connecticut playing Notre Dame. Does UConn undefeated roll, or does Notre Dame, also undefeated, but missing, as you mentioned, a key player, senior Natalie Achonwa, trip them up?
I am not 100% convinced that Notre Dame is going to get there now. I think that's a huge injury to have this late in the season and a very quick adjustment that your team has to make to playing without a major player who's played there all year. I'm not 100% sure Notre Dame gets there, but I think they will. And I think once they get there, it will be very difficult for them to compete with Connecticut without Achonwa, because I think she's just made one of their major cogs. And you don't go into the national championship game playing against a loaded Connecticut team with something less than your best team.
Michelle Smith covers women's basketball for ESPN. Thanks, Michelle.
You've got it.
When learning a new language, it's usually advisable to go for the total immersion approach. It just works better because you're totally immersed, and it's that way in sports, too. When learning to love sports after a lifelong ambivalence, you need to lose yourself among the sights, the sounds, and the supporters. Anthropology professor Evelyn Dean Olmsted learned that when she attended University of Indiana games several years ago.
Bloomington, Indiana, March 2006. I sat with a carton of Häagen-Dazs worthy of the worst breakup. My heart had broken just hours earlier in a packed sports bar called Yogi's. The buzzer rang, the Gonzaga players leapt for joy, and tears filled my eyes. I sunk my face into my boyfriend Josh's arm as he consoled me. Wait a minute, listen to that. He consoled me about a basketball game. I was shocked at my reaction. What I was feeling was nothing short of grief. No more would I wake up savoring the sweet taste of anticipation. Gone were a full half of my TV viewing options. This would require a major adjustment to my routine. This was my sport, and now it was gone. Before all of this, I had been baffled by America's obsession with sports, the billions of dollars and hours wasted. Poverty, AIDS, education, I could easily name a dozen worthier causes. The same went for my limited grad student time and money. And then a funny thing happened. We were down against Iowa when Josh turned to me and asked, with genuine concern, "Are you all right?" "I'm stressed," I said, and I was. My body was tense and my heart pounding, all for a game. It was sealed when I dressed like Princess Leia and danced for the huge overhead scoreboard at the home game against UConn. As I walked out, I remarked to my Darth Vader companion, "I love basketball." It was a revelation to myself and to him. I loved basketball. A friend once asked me why. "It's the players," I answered. "You follow them and you want them to do well. My favorite guys are Earl Calloway and Eric Soar. I just love them." "Wait, you know them?" she said. "Well, not personally, but I know them. I've been watching them all season." But it was more than this fictitious personal relationship. It was a sense of renewed hope I experienced. Every game was a new chance to succeed. I finally got it. True to my anthropological training, I'd gotten an insider's view of sports culture by immersing myself in it. I felt what fans felt, in that visceral way that only ethnography allows. I learned how sports become integrated into a person's life, how we invest in them and identify with them. I understood their value, and not just as diversion from the daily grind. It's that regular dose of hope we all need to keep us going. After the Hoosiers tournament loss to Gonzaga in 06, that hope allowed me to move into the fifth and final stage of grief, acceptance. Sports teach us that there's always another chance to redeem ourselves. There's always the next game. And when there are no more games, there's always next season.
Dr. Evelyn Dean Olmsted is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Puerto Rico, Rio Piedras. If you've loitered at the intersection of sports and anthropology, or if you simply have an interesting tale of how you became a sports fan, post your thoughts on Facebook or tweet them at us by using our new social media handles. On Twitter, we're now at OnlyAGameNPR, and on Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/OnlyAGameNPR. If you're already following us, you don't have to do anything to keep getting updates, but when you're tweeting at us or tagging us on Facebook, remember, Only a Game NPR. Coming up on Only a Game, when walking was this country's most popular spectator sport. But first, in order to win a PGA tournament with a bogey on the final hole, you have to have built up a bit of a lead. 30-year-old Stephen Bowditch won his first PGA Tour event, last week's Texas Open, in just that way. Bowditch's career has been characterized by ups and downs that have included a well-publicized struggle with major depression. Stephen, congratulations. I presume by now that you have cashed the $1,116,000 check.
Yes, sir. I actually looked into my bank account this morning and saw there was a few extra zeros in there, which was a nice surprise.
You went into the Texas Open ranked number 339 in the world, so you weren't exactly a favorite. Tell us a little bit about how it felt to finish on top in Texas.
It was wonderful. You know, it's definitely a dream, and you know, to be able to play out here on tour and now to have a win's unbelievable. You know, it was a struggle for the weekend, but it was fun and exciting, and you know, a great thrill, and just so happy to get it done.
I understand that as you were making your way through the final round on Sunday with the lead, you found yourself thinking about the upcoming Masters tournament in Augusta. You knew, of course, that winning in Texas would be your Masters entree.
Uh-huh.
That must have been a distraction from the business at hand. How did you handle it?
It wasn't just that day. You know, I've sort of been thinking about it. The first time it sort of popped in my head was after Friday when I had the lead going into Saturday. You just sort of, I guess, embrace the thoughts and just sort of keep working through them. Acknowledge they're there, and hopefully you come out the other side.
You have spoken before about suffering from clinical depression. Symptoms included terrible headaches and sometimes the inability to concentrate on anything, including golf. How did you begin to get relief from those symptoms?
You know, it's I'm grateful that this is what I was dealt with. You know, it's a part of my past, it's part of my present, and it's going to be a part of my future. And I'm just grateful that it's made me into the person I am now. You know, it's a very personal and private sort of matter. And, you know, I'm just, again, just grateful. It's just who I am, part of me.
Fellow Australians Jason Day and John Sendon have also won PGA Tour events this year, giving Australians 3 victories in 5 weeks. Next week, Australian Adam Scott will attempt to defend his 2013 Masters win. What's up with the men from down under?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess what Adam Scott and Jason Day's done for Australian golf in the last couple of years has been unbelievable, and I think it just gives us maybe a little more pep in our step, you know, and a little more drive trying to keep up with them.
We've mentioned, of course, that this was your first PGA Tour win, but you have been successful at other levels in golf. Tell me a little bit about the difference between winning on the tour and some of the winning that you've previously done.
I've been lucky enough to hold up a few trophies, you know, but there's nothing quite like the feeling I had on Sunday. When it's happened before, I've sort of been nervous for maybe, you know, 1 or 2 holes on Sunday and then sort of settle down and then maybe coming in on the last couple of holes. But this was a completely different animal. I was nervous from the moment I woke up Sunday morning, and then, you know, all day. It never settled for me, which was kind of a good thing in a way. When I got to the final few holes and after I had a lay down on that one hole and sort of gathered my thoughts and really thought about what's going on and what I needed to do, because I'd been nervous all day, it didn't really change. It never changed. So there was no real spike in my emotion or blood levels or anything like that. So I was able to get through it pretty good.
You're going to have to help me with lay down. What did that mean?
No, I on the 15th hole, I just laid down on the ground and sat there for a couple of minutes while I was waiting for my other playing competitors.
Sounds like a splendid way to psych out the opposition. You're so relaxed you could go to sleep in the fairway.
It might have looked like that, but I wasn't thinking that one.
Stephen Bowditch, winner of last weekend's Texas Open, will be among those smelling the magnolias in Augusta next week. Stephen, best of luck in Georgia, and thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. Most appreciated.
No one fears the deer these days. The Milwaukee Bucks are well on their way to securing the NBA's worst 2014 regular season record. But there are some bright prospects in Beer City. Wisconsin Public Radio's Chuck Quirnbach tells us of one, 19-year-old Milwaukee Buck Giannis Antetokounmpo, who hails from Greece.
Formal practice is over at the Bucks training site in suburban Milwaukee, but 6-foot 10-inch forward Giannis Antetokounmpo is still on the court, working on his shooting with Bucks assistant coach Josh Oppenheimer. The 19-year-old Antetokounmpo calls out as he and the coach launch 3-pointers.
Please.
That playfulness seems to be part of Antetokounmpo's personality. The Athens-born son of Nigerian immigrants has been in the U.S. less than a year. The Bucks made him their first-round draft choice last June, but he's been getting acclimated. Antetokounmpo is hip enough about American ways to kid about his favorite foods.
Like burgers, McDonald's, Wendy's, KFC, all that. No, I'm joking. Yeah, just rice, chicken, you know, pastas.
His parents arrived from Greece a couple months ago to cook him more meals. Before that, Antetokounmpo made a few visits to Milwaukee restaurant Ma Fisher's. Second-generation Greeks own the diner, and Greece native Spilios Kalogriopoulos is the second-shift manager. Kalogriopoulos says the local Greek community of about 10,000 is very proud of Antetokounmpo. He says when he attends Bucks games, he often gives him a special cheer.
For example, if I am, you know, I am in the stands and then he has the ball, and then I try to say, let's go Giannis, or Pame Giannis. Do something in Greek.
There are other Greek players in the NBA, like Nick Kalathis and Kosta Koufos, but Kalogriopoulos says Antetokounmpo has the most promise. At the Bradley Center in Milwaukee, it can take some doing for fans to stay awake through the Bucks' many losses. But if you talk to boosters wearing Antetokounmpo jerseys, like Melissa Brown, their faces light up.
Well, number 34, Antetokounmpo. I can spell that as well, Antetokounmpo. But he's my favorite player. I love him. I think he's really going to go somewhere one day, and that's the jersey I wanted.
Juan Randle isn't wearing the Antetokounmpo gear yet, as he acknowledges the rookie is only averaging about 7 points and 4 rebounds per game. Still, Randle sees a lot of potential.
He can handle the ball. His jumper will get better as he started learning the NBA game. I think they was kind of on when they said he might be close to Kevin Durant. I think he might be. Give him 3 years.
Antetokounmpo did play in the Rising Stars Challenge for rookies and sophomores at this year's NBA All-Star Weekend. Bucks coach Larry Drew says his young player has made a nice transition from playing in a second-tier league in Greece to the much more challenging NBA. But Drew does worry a little about all the hype.
He's been getting a lot of national attention, and the last thing you want is for him to get complacent. He's got to continue just to keep working his behind off and get better and better, because that is the only way he's going to get to that next level.
Drew says that next level is total consistency. Antetokounmpo says he's willing to work hard to improve, even for one of the NBA's worst teams.
It's a little bit hard, but what can we do? You know, we're just going to play hard. We're not going to give up. We're not going to give up yet. You know, we're going to play to the last game and finish strong.
The same day Antetokounmpo stayed late at practice, working on his three-pointers, he hit one late in a game against Orlando. It helped seal one of the Bucks' rare victories this year and earned a call from the PA announcer that the Bucks' hope is often repeated.
The Greek Freak for three!
For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
In the 1870s and 80s, pedestrianism was no walk in the park. In fact, it was usually a walk in an arena full of spectators. Matthew Algio explores that phenomenon in his new book, Pedestrianism: When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. He joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Matthew, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's good to be back, Bill.
Now, is America's favorite spectator sport in that subtitle an exaggeration?
No, it isn't. I guess the number one reason was there wasn't a lot else to do. There was rapid industrialization, rapid urbanization in the decades after the Civil War, millions of people moving into American cities. Live entertainment at the time was really geared toward the rich. A musical performance or a play, a ticket might cost a dollar or two. A working person was lucky to make that much a day. And so there was this entertainment deficit in the country, if you can believe that, compared to today. And so when the six-day walking matches began in the 1870s, they quickly caught on.
We will get to those arenas full of people shortly, but let's begin with a cross-country walk undertaken by one Edward Payson Weston in 1861 because he had lost a bet.
Yeah, Edward Payson Weston was a door-to-door book salesman from Providence, Rhode Island. In the autumn of 1860, he made a bet with a friend on the outcome of that year's presidential election. Weston bet that Lincoln would lose, and of course, Weston lost the bet. The loser had to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days and arrive in time to witness the inauguration of Lincoln on March 4, 1861. Of course, this was a very tense time in American history. Southern states began seceding. There wasn't a lot of good, uplifting news. And the idea that this guy would walk from Boston to Washington in the middle of winter on terrible roads, it really did capture the imagination of the public, especially along the East Coast. Huge crowds would turn out to see him just walk through their town. Weston didn't make it in time. He was 4 hours late to the inauguration. He did meet Lincoln a couple days later, and Lincoln offered to pay his rail fare home, but Weston said he would try to walk home. But the Civil War intervened.
In 1875, Edward Weston became one half of what you call, quote, the first great rivalry in the annals of American sports. Who was the other half of that rivalry?
Daniel O'Leary, an Irish immigrant from Chicago. And what happened was Weston, to capitalize on his fame, decided to take his act indoors. He began walking inside roller rinks, and he would try to walk, say, 100 miles in 24 hours and charge people a dime for the pleasure of watching him walk in circles all day. And so naturally, competitors rose up, and Daniel O'Leary, he actually walked 100 miles in 22 hours, and that set up the big showdown between Weston and O'Leary.
Tell us how one of these two-person walking events worked.
They would draw a dirt track on the floor of an arena. A lot of the races were held at the first Madison Square Garden in New York. The track was about a seventh or an eighth of a mile around. Sunday night, Monday morning, the competitors would be sent off, and they would walk continuously day and night for 6 days right up until midnight the following Saturday night. Whoever walked the farthest was the winner.
You found a newspaper account of that competition that said the crowd was motley but largely respectable. It represented wealth, standing, and brains, and thieves, gamblers, and roughs, as well as pickpockets plying their nefarious trade. Did this spectacle make money for anybody but the pickpockets?
About 10,000 people a day turned up to watch Weston and O'Leary walk, and how it usually went for the walkers was they would get a percentage of the gate. In some cases, some of the winners of the big pedestrian matches would make $19,000 for 6 days' work. That would be roughly about $400,000 today.
How often did they sleep during those 6 days?
Generally, they would sleep about 3 hours a day, spread out in 20 to 30-minute increments, and spend the other 21 hours in motion.
Mr. Weston also scheduled time to entertain the crowd, as I understand it. He played the horn a little bit when he walked and told stories, and all sorts of entertainments were available.
Yeah, we talk about Weston and O'Leary as being the Ali and Frazier. Well, Weston was definitely the Ali character. He was very flamboyant. He wore ruffled shirts and sashes, a cape. He always carried a cane. As you mentioned, he would play cornet occasionally. He intuitively understood that this was entertainment.
There were many reasons for the decline of pedestrianism. Is it fair to say that one of them was that gambling associated with the sport caused the public to begin wondering if the contests were crooked?
Yeah, the more popular pedestrianism got with the public, the more popular it got with gamblers. You could make a wager on who would be the first pedestrian to drop out of a race, who would be the second. And so gamblers began to collude with especially some of the lesser pedestrians. And in certain races, suddenly, you know, after 2 days, 12 of the 19 participants would drop out. And as soon as that began to creep in, it really meant the beginning of the end for pedestrianism.
Much as it pains me to do so, I have to ask you to tell us about how Mr. Weston's life went after he had finished competing.
Edward Weston continued to engage in long-distance walks well into his 80s. But in 1927, when he was 88, he was crossing a street in New York and was hit by a car, an electric taxi. And it was an ironic end to his career. He never walked again and died 2 years later at the age of 90. Weston detested the automobile simply because it kept people from walking.
And Dan O'Leary, how did he fare after his competitive walking days were over?
Into the 1920s, he would stage walking exhibitions before baseball games. He would walk once around the bases while the fastest player on the team would try to run twice around the bases. And then he would pass the hat and collect nickels and dimes from the crowd. And this is basically how he funded his retirement. In 1927, it was a game between the A's and the White Sox in Chicago where he did one of these tricks. And I just imagine the guys in the dugout watching this old man walking around the bases, but they would have been blown away to know he made more in 6 days than most of them would make for the entire season in 1927.
Matthew Algio is the author of Pedestrianism: When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. Matthew, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome, Bill.
To read my review of Pedestrianism and an excerpt from the book, please move your digits over to our digital domain, onlyagame.org.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack. And the Music Emporium, for 45 years, offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, how a Wall Street Journal reporter gets nailed by the NCAA's Illicit Crockery Enforcement Unit and lives to tell the tale. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Well, the NCAA has been a crock for a long time,
yeah,
so I'm not surprised by this.
Now we don't have to run that story. The punchline is already there. For the past couple of weeks, you've been flying around the country in search of the perfect NCAA tournament basketball game. Did you find it?
No, but I found a lot of really good ones, especially the Midwest Regional last weekend, which featured two great games in the semifinals between Michigan and Tennessee and between Kentucky and Louisville, and a great, great final between Michigan and Kentucky.
Since we last spoke, the baseball season has gotten underway.
No!
Oh, yeah, it got by you again. Any storylines that you are determined to watch as the long and winding road of the season unfolds?
Well, one of the really terrible ones, of course, is that we have to pay attention to the Yankees again, they having retooled practically their entire team in the offseason. I'm going to be interested to see if Miguel Cabrera can earn his money with Detroit, since nobody in the world could earn what Miguel Cabrera is making from the Tigers.
Which is $250 million.
Yes, I don't think anybody out there can earn $250 million, but I'm willing to be proven wrong.
The Boston Red Sox visited President Obama this week. That's what happens when you win the World Series. And David Ortiz took a selfie with the president. Good, clean, innocent fun at the White House, right?
No, he got paid to do it. He's got an endorsement contract with Samsung, and there we are.
See, that's the problem with radio. The selfie wouldn't earn me anything.
You could do it, though. You could try. If you could scam some money out of Samsung and share it with me, that would be great.
As we discussed last week, the Eagles released talented receiver DeSean Jackson, allegedly for his off-field connections to gang members. Now the NFL Players Association is investigating that. I thought the NFL teams could cut players at any time for any reason. Am I wrong?
Well, I think given the nature of the standard NFL contract, you're probably right, but the NFLPA is right to investigate this one because it sounds like basically it was done on pure innuendo.
The College Athletes Players Association sent a delegation to Washington this week in order to discuss with various congresspeople why Northwestern's college football players should indeed have a union. I wonder if they convinced Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander that unionization of college football players wouldn't, quote, destroy intercollegiate athletics as we know it, which is what he claimed it would do.
First of all, I think you can convince either of Tennessee's senators of anything positive coming from any unionization drive whatsoever. But no, I don't think they will convince Senator Lamar. Unfortunately for the NCAA, the system is coming down, and it all depends on how hard the landing is.
For the record, I assume Senator Alexander thought that destruction of intercollegiate athletics as we know it would be a bad thing.
I was about to point out that, yeah, I mean, he says this as though it were a bad thing.
The Federal Office for Civil Rights has launched an investigation into how Florida State handled sexual assault allegations against quarterback Jameis Winston. What's the necessity of this investigation?
Well, obviously the Office of Civil Rights is dissatisfied with the fact that no charges were preferred in the original investigation. Their standard of proof is a little bit looser. You can commit unlawful sexual harassment under Title IX even if they don't have evidence of a criminal violation. Basically, they're saying in a nice, polite way, they think FSU's investigation was a whitewash and they want more information.
The Masters Golf Tournament begins on Thursday. Tiger Woods will not be there. He's out after back surgery. So does anybody watch?
I think some people will watch. I think fewer people will watch. But according to some marketing people, it's a good idea because it will raise the profile of other brands. You know, you may not know that golf tournaments are now contested by brands rather than actual human beings.
Has it affected ticket prices as well?
Well, apparently they're going to be a little easier to get, at least according to the scalper, ticket brokers. It's a strong ticket, people are saying. It's still in demand, but people go just because it's the Masters now and not because they want to see Tiger.
Members of a lacrosse team from Penn have been accused of breaking up a bar on Saturday night. Charlie, just another story about a boys' night out?
No, it's just another story about a girls' night out, Bill. Oops. This is the Pennsylvania women's lacrosse team, which has been engaged in, according to people at the bar, quote, absolutely deplorable behavior. The bar owner complained that the team members intentionally broke the facilities, including a light fixture. They stole a bottle of liquor from the bar, tried to steal a six-pack of beer, and then they claimed that they smoked marijuana in the bathroom. Worst of all, they only tipped 4% on a $1,300 bar tab.
Oh, man. Finally, Charlie, Derek Jeter's season-long farewell tour is off to a fine start. The Houston Astros presented the retiring Yankee shortstop with a pair of cowboy boots, very fancy boots featuring the Yankees logo and Derek Jeter's number, and he also got a cowboy hat, and he got a set of golf clubs, and I wonder if Jeter already had a set of golf clubs.
Well, I think he's going to wind up having a lot of set of golf clubs. In fact, I think that Derek Jeter is probably going to have to build another wing on his house, because there are a lot of teams in baseball, and they're all going to want to say goodbye, and they don't all have very good imaginations.
I want to see him try and play short in those boots.
I want to see him wear the hat. I want to see him wear either the boots or the hat ever in his life.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Ann Abernathy has been defying odds her entire life. After graduation from college, Abernathy became a professional singer and performed all over the country. Then she was introduced to the sport of luge and qualified for 6 Winter Olympics after beating cancer. Now at age 60, when many people her age are thinking about retirement, Abernathy is taking on a new challenge. Reporter Lauren Ober has the story.
On a recent weekday afternoon, Ann Abernathy is navigating a set of stairs at the Bull Run Public Shooting Center in Centerville, Virginia. With one hand on the railing and the other hand on a cane, Abernathy slowly picks her way down the stairs leading to the subterranean archery range. This isn't exactly what you expect to witness when you're meeting an Olympic hopeful. But then, the Virginia woman isn't your average athlete.
I'm 60 years old. I'm not a young pup at this.
But there are other issues beside her age and the recent knee operation that makes her hobble around. Abernathy is a total beginner at this sport. She picked up archery only 14 months ago.
I only know how to train for the Olympics. I don't know how to do something just recreational.
And so it is that Abernathy, a sexagenarian archery novice, has her sights set on the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. If she makes it, she will likely be the oldest competitor in the Games. But it won't be the first time. Abernathy is a 6-time Olympian, a fact she will tell you many times in the course of a conversation. She represented her adopted home of the U.S. Virgin Islands in the sliding sport of luge and wears a gold necklace featuring the Olympic rings as a constant reminder. At the time of her first Olympics, the 1988 Calgary Games, Abernathy was 34. She went on to compete in Albertville, Lillehammer, Nagano, Salt Lake City, and Torino.
When I first started, I didn't think Olympics. I just thought I really enjoy doing this sport. But luge takes a toll on the body. And although I really love the sport, my body had had enough.
She's not kidding about that. Since taking up luge in the 80s, Abernathy has had 19 knee operations and a smattering of other surgeries. She's had countless head injuries, and she's even broken her back. With that in mind, archery seems like a way safer option.
Here's one of the problems that I have, and it's from the back injury. If I shoot 144 arrows in a day, the elbow bends more and more and more when it needs to be straight out.
To understand Abernathy's obsession with the Olympics and with sport in general, you have to know a little something about her upbringing. She was born in Florida to a father in the Air Force and a mother who didn't think it was appropriate for girls to play sports.
Well, I love playing softball. My mom wouldn't let me. I wasn't allowed to do any sports in school. I could swim. I was allowed to swim and play tennis.
Decades later, Abernathy discovered luge during a ski trip to Lake Placid. At the 1980 Winter Olympic venue, Abernathy and some friends watched the sliders fly down the track. Soon, a luge coach sidled up to them.
And he said, anybody wants to try it, take a step forward. And immediately, 18 people took a step back. And I was a little slower than the others. And I was there, and I turned to the guy next to me, and we looked at each other, and I said, why not?
And so began Ann Abernathy's 20-year luge career. She never medaled at the Olympics, but she did get to travel to competitions around the world. Over the years, she picked up a nickname, Grandma Luge.
Keep the wrist up. Come on.
At the Bull Run Shooting Center, Abernathy is working with a fellow Olympian to hone her newfound archery skills. Ruth Rowe competed in the 1984 Summer Games in Los Angeles as a member of the U.S. archery team, and the pair make a perfect combo. They tease and bicker like an old married couple, and they have their own way of communicating.
Ruth will see me across the room and she'll say, steer.
Everybody else goes blank.
And everybody goes, what? And what she means is use the same muscles that I use to steer with. So we have our own language that we were able to pick up by combining both of the sports. It got me to World Cup last year within my first 12 months.
What are you trying to aim? Blank bill, you don't aim.
I know. It just doesn't feel right unless I do aim at something.
Look.
I'm looking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The 66-year-old Rowe seems to understand her student's particular set of challenges. She's had to adjust the way Abernathy shoots because the former luger can no longer fully straighten her right arm. But Rowe believes in her.
She has the discipline of training. She's had the experience in high-level competition. She knows how to handle herself mentally.
But what might make Abernathy's march to Rio even harder than it already is the fact that she's low on cash. Unlike many other Olympic hopefuls who ink sponsorship deals with shoe or car or yogurt companies, Abernathy has to find the money to compete. Olympic training is not cheap.
It's a massive expense. And I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to get there. I'm getting there on a shoestring right now. And I'm hoping that somebody will jump on board and help me get there. When I got to my last Olympics in Luge, I literally got there one t-shirt at a time.
To that end, Abernathy was, until recently, couch surfing at a friend's house in Falls Church, Virginia to cut down on expenses. Then a couple of weeks ago, a family in nearby Vienna adopted the Olympian, allowing her to stay in their house rent-free while she trains with Ruth Rowe at Bull Run. It's just one of many sacrifices Abernathy is making to hit the bullseye on this particular dream. What happens if you don't make it?
I don't even think that way. That's not... My brain doesn't even... I don't know how to answer that question. There is no not making it.
The World Archery Finals, which will help determine who goes to the Rio Games, will be held in Lausanne, Switzerland in September. Anne Abernathy fully intends on being there. For Only a Game, I'm Lauren Ober.
Sponsors for this weekend's Men's Final Four in Dallas include a major phone company that keeps things simple, a candy manufacturer that makes chocolate that once lured an alien, and a prominent hydration drink. Sponsors for the Men's Final Four do not include the maker of a 12-ounce ceramic mug covered in drawings of cats. Therein lies the crux of sports writer Jason Gay's column in the Wall Street Journal this week. Jason, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, happy to be here. And, you know, I know you've had a lot of serious reporters on this program over the years, but I just assume this has to be the most hard-hitting piece of sports journalism you've ever had.
It's among them, absolutely, as they say. The cat mug in question
yes.
accompanied you to the East Regional Final at Madison Square Garden last Sunday.
Yes.
Why was the cat mug chosen for this important mission?
Always the answer is, why not a cat mug, Bill? But the reason I wanted to do it was, as someone who had covered several NCAA tournaments over the years, had gotten the experience of the cup police at the NCAA tournament. They make a big point of it. There are signs leading into the arena that say, NCAA cups only. There are cups there for your taking if you make the mistake of bringing in an outside cup. Mm. Basically, this is a policy that you see at other kinds of events, but it's just so strictly enforced at the NCAA. I just found it comical, and I wanted to push it a little bit. Therefore, I brought in the cat mug.
You did not take along the cat mug and tweet out a couple of pictures of it by accident, as you have suggested, or because you didn't know that outside cups
Bill,
were banned by the NCAA.
We're going to be 100% on the level here. This was a cat mug provocation inflicted by myself, and I got what I was looking for.
And what you were looking for, eventually your mug was confiscated by an NCAA staffer who I'm sure did not smile. Was he at all embarrassed to be asking you to turn over your piece of illicit crockery?
Bill, this happened with about 4 minutes to go, and it has occurred to me that had they just let it go, we wouldn't be sitting here talking. I mean, this just would have been a non-story. I wouldn't have gotten anything out of it. But with about 4 minutes to go, and this was a great game, let's not forget, UConn and Michigan State, this individual came over and made a joke about taking the cup and mailing it to me, and I thought we were just having a laugh about it, but then it became relatively clear that the cup was being asked for. We look around and we see the incredible compensation for conferences and coaches, and at the same time, the strict enforcement of the smallest kinds of rules against college athletes. And I wanted to, in a very small way, call attention to what I feel is sort of a strange kind of selective enforcement of the NCAA.
As journalists covering these sorts of events, we are, of course, bound by whatever rules the team or the league or the NCAA decides to enforce.
Absolutely.
Did you consider at all refusing to hand over the mug?
You know what? I wish I was a stronger, bolder man, Bill. I really do. But I just wasn't capable of it. I chickened out. I just chickened out, Bill. You know, it occurred to me, and it's important to note here that the Wall Street Journal does not just cover sports through the prism of cat mugs, that there are a great many terrific reporters, many of whom have been in your program, who cover collegiate sport in a very aggressive and thoughtful way. And I wasn't about to, like, impugn their work by getting caught up in the big cat mug controversy of 2014. You know, I didn't want them to lose their ability to cover the sport. So, yeah, I chickened out, Bill. What do you want from me?
And you did ultimately get the confiscated cat mug back, right?
Yeah. The Smithsonian is yet to ask for it, Bill.
No, it's not going to be the Smithsonian, Jason. It's going to be the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Springfield. Oh,
yeah.
That would be an incredible honor. Nothing would be better. I could be right there next to the peach basket, Bill.
Absolutely. Jason Gay writes about sports for the Wall Street Journal. You can find a link to his article about the cat mug at our website, onlyagame.org. Jason, thank you very much for joining
us. Bill, and I'll see you at the Pulitzer ceremony next year, okay?
Absolutely. Now, look, one last thing. I assume you own a cat. And if so, does your cat have a Jason mug or perhaps a bowl or maybe a Jason litter box?
How meta do you think I am, Bill? Come on. There are limits to this absurdity, Bill.
Radio is a hot medium, which means listening helps you use your imagination. Mugs are made to hold hot drinks, so why wouldn't you go to onlyagame.org and check out the totally hot picture of Jason Gay's cat mug that was confiscated by the NCAA? Please go to our website, onlyagame.org. To see Lauren Ober's photos of Granny Luge, visit our Facebook page. We've got a new address, facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. If you've already liked us on Facebook, you'll still get our posts. But if you haven't yet, check out facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. That's our new Twitter handle, too, by the way. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Martin Kessler. Our intern is Zoe Sobel, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week is from NCAA Chief Illicit Crockery Investigator Fuzzy Calico. It's a fine thing that Jason Gay's cat mug wasn't harmed when it was confiscated, isn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.